Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett.
And Fred Schenkelberg.
And welcome to our edition of Speaking of Reliability. How's it going, Fred?
Hey, pretty good. Yeah, it's kind of that fall, early winter feel around here. It's getting into the holidays, but it's also the clients are just wanting to do all. I've had more clients in the last month than I had all year. It's
what
crazy.
What else are you going to do in the fall, right? The summer vacations are done and get everything done before the holiday.
Yeah, you know, it's busy, it's good, and lots of interesting projects, all kinds of different things. But yet, it also feels like, why can't you guys space this out a little better? Are they coordinating this? You know, it's everybody. Let's call Fred on Friday, and it's like
right.
Yeah, I think there's a statistical theorem on that, you know, like Curing theory or something.
Right. I think that's probably going to go more into psychology than anything on perspective. And it's one of those things where actually that's an interesting thing to talk about even with data is, do you know how it always feels like when you pass a bicyclist on the road when you're in a car and it feels like there's always a car coming the other way?
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, right. So, but of course, that doesn't make sense statistically. But what's occurring is all the times you pass a car, or you pass a bicycle, and there's not a car coming the other way, you don't even bother recording the event in your mind.
That's right.
Right? And you only record the ones that are stressful.
Yeah. But you see it in companies too, right? Have you ever, a habit of mine is when I'm at lunch with clients and with folk engineers, is say, so what major disasters do you remember? You know, big problems you've had in the past, and they can remember them. There's stories associated with it, and the all-nighters and jumping through hoops to solve problems. And if you would have asked the question of, so do you remember a week when no customers complain about your product? Like, no.
Right.
It's like, right. Yeah, you remember the events and things you had to make decisions on and deal with. But yeah, it's not just all doom and gloom in the reliability world. There's other good stuff that happens too. Unfortunately, we don't get credit as much credit for that when it goes well. I think that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And it's hard to measure too. And your customers view things the same way. I mean, the expectations are when Toyota makes one little mistake, it's a huge deal and everybody's all over them, right?
Right.
And it's because of their good track record. So
yeah, well, other companies can't get a product out there at all.
Right. So then what kind of data do you try to generate and track in advance so that you can truly accurate all those, you know, track all those times you passed a bicyclist and there wasn't a car coming the other way? So you do have a true measure of frequency of, you know, hazard.
Well, you know, I ran into that with this similar phenomena, maybe not the same phenomena where they weren't recording it, but they were tracking returns. They shipped a product and it was a single use product, but it had a certain shelf life and customers would use their device. And if it didn't work, they'd complain about it. It was relatively expensive, so they would send it back. And so the company only tracked returns. And I says, well, what do you compare that to? And he says, well, we compare it to last month. You know, so we had 48 returns last month and we had 36 returns this month and, oh, we're doing great. And I says, well, how many customers actually have your product and how many, you know, how many are expected to be at risk of being used this month? And, oh, I don't know. You know, so if last month you had 400,000 units available or had been used and this month you only had 75, well, then your data is misleading. And they kind of looked at me with a blank stare. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah. But it's also a hard request to execute because it can be very difficult to have access to your data. So many products. I actually had a recent customer. It was interesting talking with them because we were doing a lot of testing and development work. And I was trying to get more historical data on, you know, performance. Mm-hmm. So we had an idea how to translate some of the data. And it's so difficult. This is a product that's sold in unbelievably high volume, but it's a product with, like, let's say less than a $70 cost point. You know, mm-hmm. it's sold in tons of major outlets. You know, you'd buy it on Amazon, you'd buy it at Walmart, you'd buy it everywhere. But when customers return them, you know, they have a call line, right. but customers don't ever call them. They return them to Home Depot or Walmart or whatever. Those places just, you know, don't send them back to the company. Or if they do, the hysterical thing is they just throw tons of them unpackaged in a box and smashed. They all show up smashed up.
Right.
Totally smashed just from getting sent back. And the only time customers engage with them is when customers have people who are very passionate about the product call with ideas or complaints regarding the design. So mm-hmm. in other words, it's not misbehaving. It's just not doing what they want right. by design. So they really have very few options for truly tracking what happens.
Yeah, it's a weird phenomenon. And I think different price points make different setups. But it goes to that point of we need more than just a count of data back. And I think we've talked about root cause analysis, or at least on the show, I know we have, but there's one, I'm drawing a complete blank on his name, but it's, you can analyze field data by just the shipments you make and the returns you get. Right. And you make a few assumptions about how many are still in service or have been used. Right. Because it gets really muddled when you're, like you're describing, it gets sent back to the store and it's not economical to ship them back. And it's not you're not required to get the product back to get a replacement or the price back, or it's not repairable, those kinds of things. But just doing shipments and returns, it is possible to get an estimate of that. I don't know that it's the best data, but it's better than nothing. And it brings up the point that I had a client ask me one time years ago. It says, is it possible to get perfect field data?
Right. You know? Right. That would require that would require the kind of financial investment that the return on investment doesn't make sense. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do know of products where an employee is effectively on site, like an employee of the manufacturers.
Right.
The equipment's so expensive and so complex that you have one of your employees on site participating in the use of it, right? So that you do have potential there for getting, I guess, as perfect data as you can.
Well, you can get better data. I've seen that happen where the employee on site is there to make sure it keeps running. So they're really focused on the repair and maintenance and put the item back into service. And then they forget what they fixed, or they don't record it, or it's, I mean, there's plenty of issues with that. And even machines that are completely censored up and data loggers recording every incident and every down moment and all that stuff. I think then you have the opposite problem. You got terabytes of data, nobody looking at it because you only need the little piece of interest and not everything, not all the telemetry coming off the system.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be smart how you use it. I mean, at that point, you shouldn't be sifting through the data. You should be solving a problem and the data is there when you search. You know, it's kind of like the internet. I mean, Google can access everything, but you type in searches for information you need.
That's right. I don't need everything.
You hope that they don't hit any dead ends, right, when they're searching for something at that point.
Yeah.
Is the objective.
Yeah. Well, we get that, you know, oh yeah, it's online. Even within companies. Oh, it's in the share drive, right?
Yeah.
Okay. that narrows it down to pretty close to infinity.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So, I mean, we can spend money and get better data. We can get stuff back from the field if we pay for it, you know, and do the reverse logistics of it. I think as a minimum, companies need to have the number of shipments and the number of failures. And then with a few assumptions about how long a product would be in service, you can do basic reliability estimates and calculations. Right.
I feel like the question gelling from this mm-hmm. is how would you estimate for yourself what the right amount of investment is to create data? Because that's actually an interesting question, right? That if I was a business owner, I'd mm-hmm. be sitting here thinking as I was listening to this, I have the two extremes. I have the I'm not really getting any. And what is that costing me?
Right.
And I have the I could overshoot and spend way too much money getting it and it's not worth it. because maybe my customer, you know, maybe I'm going to end up controlling reliability to a factor is not necessary for my product profile, or so there's the question, really. How do you know how much you should invest?
Well, it starts with, it's easy for me when the warranty accruals, or the warranty expenses in the estimates of cost of unreliability are as big or bigger than your development project funding, right? If you're spending 5% of net revenue on warranty and you're spending 5 or 6% of net revenue on R&D and product development, well, something's wrong here. and of course it's relative to your market, but I think it comes down to are you spending too much on failed products? And whether it's warranty or engineering time fixing things or whatever you want to tally up, if that's the largest bucket of opportunity for you to reduce costs, then I think you need to invest in getting better data.
Yeah.
Right.
So then that to me seems like a very broad stroke. So for me, if I was a business owner and wanted to take action, the question would be, what do I invest in? Mm-hmm. So what's a dollar value I invest in? So I'm, you know, like you said, okay, so it's 5%. I'm like, that's kind of high. What do I do next? How do I decide how much to invest? Do I say I invest 1% of that? You know, do I invest 20% of that 5%? So 1% of my total product.
Yeah,
cost?
No, it's an ROI question. You know, what are your other opportunities for either product improvements or cost reductions or increased revenue or whatever? As a business owner, you've got sales and all these other options to invest in. And investing on warranty reduction is like all the rest of them. So if I've got, say, I'll use round numbers, I have $100,000 in warranty expected for this year, and I use a 20-to-1 return on investment, then I need to invest $5,000 into reducing warranty. Now, that may be increasing product costs by using more robust products or doing some training or just improving the failure analysis so that we know what to fix. It could be a range of different options, but I look at it as purely a financial decision. And now, on the other hand, if you read Phil Crosby's book from the late 70s called Quality is Free, then you would invest at a much higher ratio, because warranty and the direct cost of unreliability is a small fraction of the total cost. And so in his book, he was arguing that you continue to invest because you'll continue to get dividends from it in market share and brand loyalty and those things, which are much more impactful to the bottom line than just reducing cost.
I think he was introducing a very important concept to shift the general industry in that direction. It needed a strong shift in that direction. Mm-hmm. But I also think that you can make mistakes there. And this is how you'd make a mistake. If you had a product that one of the key factors that your customer base looked for was cost point, and you, in doing that, drove up the cost, you might actually, you know, where they, your customer's not as concerned. You know, I always use that example of the power drill, right?
Right.
Yeah. Because a power drill is interesting because there's so many variations on it. And you have the ones that you and I buy as homeowners. You can literally buy one for $28, a really powerful, good hand drill.
Yep.
And when you and I go through the store, we look at costs. Like, I don't even look at the ones, you know, for my general workshop that are over $100. I'm like, I don't want to spend that. I'm going to use this thing, you know, 3 times a month.
Right.
So if you did that kind of program with that product, you offered a product with the same features and whatever, and you drove the cost up, I would just walk right by it. It wouldn't be my consideration. So,
if you're in the market for the contractors where they put a high value on it, just works. I never have to worry about this breaking on me. Then another $20 won't matter.
Oh my God. Well, the cost is devastating to them if it breaks because they have workers standing around.
That's right.
Which is it's thousands of dollars. So who cares if the thing's $500? But when he was writing that, America and the world even was very much shifted towards that, you know, not monitoring at all. So he gave a very general broad stroke statement. But it's tricky too, because sometimes those products that are $28, the manufacturer really has a profit margin of a dollar or less than a dollar.
Right.
So it gets, you know, even simple additions to programs can have, you know, can really, really have a high expense, so to speak, with the entire purpose of the business.
It's very true. Yet I have lost count of how many organizations I've been in where they'll have five or six engineers working for 5 months on reducing the cost of some mechanical system by a nickel per unit shipped.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, how much does it cost when your product fails and how many you're shipping? And we work out the math for what's the warranty cost per unit shipped. And it's, you know, it's $20, $30 per unit shipped. And who's working on reducing warranty costs? Oh, we can't do that. That's not, we don't pay that. Another part of the organization does, or we don't consider that. And so let's say you cost reduce yourself and you increase by 0.1% your warranty cost. You've completely wiped out your nickel savings. And somewhere in the organization is going to have to pay for that. Do you guys want to work through this again? You know, but yeah. It's organization after organization,
right.
Looking at cost reduction or increased features or whatever, yet it's blind to the opportunities for reliability improvements and the
right.
benefits.
Well, now you just pulled this into my favorite arena, you know, organizational culture, right? Because mm-hmm. that the core of that is, where do those initiatives meet in the organization? You know, as you said, their answer is, oh, that's somewhere else in the organization.
Right.
Well, there's not a desk where those two things are meeting and somebody's like, hey, wait a minute,
you know,
this doesn't make sense. So that comes down to evaluating the organization and how information moves and accountability. I've actually started creating these diagrams for some of my customers of like, they're not an org chart, but it's an accountability chart with inputs and outputs.
Okay.
And it shows where accountability and you know, driving factors and decisions, how they flow. So what you just said would show a problem with those two never meeting at the right point.
Well, or not meeting at all, you know, especially if you're not tracking it. If it's the finance guys are doing a month in, month out, watching the trends, but not doing anything, not reporting it to anybody, not caring about it. They're just filling out the form, right? So the R&D team and nobody else then has visibility to it. And it's like, oh, yeah, I got to see some of these drawings. I think we've gone, you know, originally I was bringing up more of the, you know, reliability data, and I thought we were going to head into censoring and all that stuff. But I agree that it's way more important that when we're looking at kinds of information or data to look at, who's making what decisions and who needs what kind of information is much more critical than what tally sheet I set up.
Are you really surprised the conversation went that way when you started it with me?
No.
Okay. No. I was going to say, there's other people you can call if you just want to stick in sensory to some of that.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much going to turn it to the people and how the organization's running pretty quick.
Yeah, that's true. I should have suspected that.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't think the answer is that you just collect data, right? Yet if you're doing a monthly dashboard or a report and you're counting failures coming back in, who's using it? Is that good enough information to be used? And that might be what you just highlighted, though, Adam, is that in some organizations, that's broken. That being who needs what level of detail in the data for it to be useful for them. And if there's no audience for it, well, that's a different problem than collecting the data by itself.
Right.
Yeah. It's usually when I work out how much it costs per unit shipped. And I learned that from Dick Moss way back when I was at HP. And he said, you know, we make a laptop and then we fill it up with a bunch of components and instruction manuals and all the other stuff that goes into the box. And then we put in $100 bill. He says, what? He goes, yeah, that's how much it costs per unit shipped for our warranty.
Mm-hmm.
And when you make it literal to that product being shipped, then it's, oh, well, that changes the frame a little bit here. I need to think about this different. So I think a big part of the reliability data of whatever our situation is, whatever our organization, and it has to help frame the discussion with the appropriate people so that you can make good decisions. The data by itself is not all that terribly useful.
Yeah. It's really interesting. It is. It's like everybody has, you know, everybody has access to the whole internet, but right. That doesn't say anything about what you're going to create.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, I think that's a, I don't know. I'm afraid to bring up another topic because we'll probably talk another 25 minutes on it. But
it sounds like another episode.
Sounds like another episode.
I think our next topic could be, do you know what I ordered last night? I'm pretty excited. I ordered a high voltage transformer, pulse generator inverter, so that I can take 6 volts and turn it into 80 kV spikes, because I want to try and see if in vacuum I can create small plasma, but I also figured I should tell people in case nobody ever hears from me again. Do you know what an 80 kV spike does to the human body in rapid pulses?
Probably not good things.
No. So I just, I'm pretty excited, but I'm also, it's like one of those things where after I ordered, I'm like, oh yeah, this is totally like one of those things where you look back when you're in the hospital and you're like, what the hell was I thinking?
Yeah.
But
you're going to use this on your boat, right? While you're out in the lake.
It's been the workshop, but I am excited because it will be an interesting reliability problem, because you know there's so many variables to keeping something like that running, where you keep an arc, you know, a high voltage arc running like that. So it kind of will be interesting to see what variables and dials I'm able to create and control, you know, to control this.
I just did a quick Google search here, Adam, and speaking of Google searches, and you can get one of those little globes that has like the little arc going out to the glass, and you put your hand on it and it changes the capacitance. And, you know, that's not enough for you?
No, that's not enough. There's no, I give it like a fire department rating, like the odds that I'm going to get to see my friends at the fire department, like, you know, so that's very low. Like, this is more like a 7. Yeah, this is a little higher.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so. Okay. Yeah, you're crazy. All right.
Yeah.
We'll tune back in if you can still speak in another episode.
Well, that'd be a whole other episode. Are you kidding? If I get this thing running, it'd be good. But
okay.
Yeah. Actually, the funny thing is too, I have to look to see if there's a chance I'm going to create X-rays. I don't think I will, but it would be very low if it was.
You have to think about arc flashing too.
Keep it excited. Yeah.
That would be bad. All right, cool. Well, hope you survive there, Adam. And let's ask our listeners to place a bet, basically, on Adam's chance of survival.
The Deadpool.
Yeah. But seriously, if you've got a comment or an idea you'd like us to chat about or like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And please leave us a comment. We'd love to hear from you. So with that, Adam, I think we can wrap this one up.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Thanks, Adam. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.